Let's review a little bit from last week. We began by reading the first Mishnah in Tractate Brachot, which expressed that according to all opinions, the earliest time to say Shema at night is at Seisa Kochavim, nightfall. And at a later time, we'll discuss why the Mishnah specifically uses the language of the Kohanim eating their truma instead of just saying nightfall. That's not our topic now. But the commentaries all question the common practice, which is in shuls to daven ma'ariv early and to say Shema way before nightfall. Here, you know, many shuls in America today, we say it at least after sunset. But even today in Europe, if you go to England, to most synagogues, ma'ariv is before sunset because sunset's way too late. Nobody's coming to ma'ariv that late. Especially in the summer. So the commentaries all wonder, why is it that that we say Shema so early at shul? Rashi suggested that the Shema that we say in shul is not the Shema that fulfills the mitzvah of Kriyas Shema, but rather you fulfill that mitzvah later on when you say Shema at night. Tosfot had four questions. Tosfot had four questions about that Rashi, four difficulties. One difficulty was that the Shema at bedtime is only for the... First of all, the Shema at bedtime, you only say the first paragraph. You don't say the whole Shema. Rashi didn't have a problem with that. And we saw in the Sefer Achinuch that, you know, it's not really so clear that you have to say all three paragraphs of Shema to fulfill the mitzvah. That's number one. Number two, the bedtime Shema, according to the Gemara later on, is only in order to ward off demons. And so, according to the Gemara, it's not there to fulfill the mitzvah. Three, we say all the brachos before Kriyat Shema at shul. And if those are Birkot HaMitzvah, which is what Tosfos assumes, how could we say Birkot HaMitzvah, blessings upon a commandment, if we're not really fulfilling a mitzvah? And four, it creates a difficulty with regards to Geula and Tefillah, which is more complicated, and we don't need to spend time right now going through it. Suffice it to say, if you were here last week, you know that difficulty as well. Okay, but many difficulties on Rashi. Before we look at Tosfos' answer, I just want to point out that Rashi... Even Rashi, when he said, you don't fulfill the mitzvah at shul, he doesn't tell you to go home and then say Shema again. He says that what you're already doing, which is saying the bedtime Shema, ipso facto fulfills the mitzvah. Right? He doesn't tell you to do something you don't already do. That's Rashi, that's what Rashi does. Tosfos is also going to do something very similar. But before we read the Tosfos, we're going to read the commentary of Rabbeinu Yonah. Rabbeinu Yonah comes from a very different tradition than Rashi and Tosfos. Rashi and Tosfos belong to Ashkenaz, lived in Ashkenaz, in France and in Germany. And Rabbeinu Yonah was a Sephardic Rishon who lived in Spain. He's a cousin of the Ramban in 13th century Spain. Look at what Rabbeinu Yonah has the very same, Yonah of Gerona. He has the very same problem with Shema. It's on the first page, page one, where I put the arrow. The top, there's three arrows. This is the first arrow. V'cheivan shekriyat Shema shel Beit HaKneset eino latzet yedei chova. Since the Shema that you say in shul does not fulfill the mitzvah, ואחרכך צריך לקרותה בבית, לצאת ידי חיוב של תורה. And then later, what do you have to do? You have to go home and say Shema again in order to fulfill the mitzvah. צריך כל אדם להיות נזהר בקריאתה. Everyone has to be very careful to go home and read Shema again. ושלא יסמוך, ושלא יסמוך, ala kriya shekorel mitato mipnei kama dvarim. And you shouldn't count on the Shema that you say at your bedside before you go to sleep. The opposite of Rashi, right? Rashi said, you go home and you read Shema at night, later, much later, that'll fulfill the mitzvah. Rabbeinu Yonah says, not at all. The Shema that you say at bedtime does not fulfill the mitzvah of Kriyat Shema. I don't want to read the four reasons because it's going to take up, it's the rest of the paragraph. But I'll tell you the four reasons. He says four reasons why bedtime Shema doesn't count. Number one, eat because you eat dinner before you say that Shema. And later on in the Gemara will say that you're not allowed to eat before you recite the Shema at night. Before you recite the mitzvah Shema, after nightfall, you're not allowed to eat. So Rabbeinu Yonah is going to suggest that as soon as nightfall hits, you know, Seita Kochavim is 6:27 as it was last night. As soon as you go home after 6:27, you have to recite Shema. Before you eat anything after 6:27. The second one is the same thing the Tosfos said. The Gemara said that the Kriyat Shema at the bedside is only to ward off the demons. And so as a result of that, because the Gemara says that it's only to ward off demons, and Rabbeinu Yonah assumes that many people know that, people won't have the proper kavana when they say Shema at their bedside. In order to fulfill a mitzvah, presumably you're supposed to have the kavana to fulfill that mitzvah, the intention to fulfill that mitzvah. And if you're saying Shema at night with the assumption, since you learned the Gemara, with the assumption that it's only to ward off the demons, you won't have the proper intention to fulfill the mitzvah. You'll have the intention, oh, I'm saying Shema to ward off the demons. You won't be thinking I'm saying Shema to fulfill the mitzvah. And then he says also that at bedtime, everybody only says the first paragraph, nobody says the other paragraphs, and you have to say the other paragraphs also. So that's basically what Rabbeinu Yonah says. If you take a look at the second arrow, Umitnei kol hata'amim ha'elu, for all these reasons, tzarich shelo lismoch latzeit yedei chova alota shekorin samuch lamita. For all these reasons, you're not supposed to bank on the Shema that you read at night by your bed. V'tzarich gam kein shelo lehisamech alota shel beit ha'knesset. And also, you shouldn't count on the Shema that you said in Shul. Rather, so what should you do? It's not the Shema that you said in Shul, and it's not the Shema that you're going to say later on when you go to bed. What should you do? Elakach hu ha'inyan. It's the next paragraph with the bold word. Elakach hu ha'inyan. Shebebeit ha'knesset yikra kriyat Shema im birchoteha. At Shul, you should read Shema with all the brachos like we all do. V'lo yekavein latzeit yedei chovat kriyat shma be'ota kriya. And you should not have the intention to fulfill the mitzvah, the biblical command to say shma when you daven ma'ariv at shul. Ela la'amod b'tfila mitoch divrei Torah. Rather, you should only have the intention that you're reading some Torah before you begin davening. We discussed that last week as well. Just like you say Ashrei before Mincha. You're supposed to read, and we say Rabbi Yishmael before we begin Shacharis. You're supposed to read some Torah before you daven. Ve'yotzei yedei kriyat ha-brachot. And that's when you read the brachos. Ve'achar kach, k'shehiye beveito. Later, when you're home. Kodem sheyochal. Before you eat. Achar yetziyat ha-kochavim, after nightfall, yekrauta. That's when you should read Shema again. V'yitkavein latzet b'yedei chova. And then you should intend to fulfill the mitzvah. V'yikrauta kula b'mora uvekavanat ha-lev. And you should read the Shema at that point, in awe and with intent in your heart. Okay? And then he goes on to quote other Gaonim, Babylonian Gaonim, who agreed with him that you don't fulfill the mitzvah by reading Shema at the bedside. Okay. Rabbeinu Yonah says he adds a new practice. Right? Unlike Rashi, Rashi had suggested that the Shema that you recite at night, anyway, what you're doing anyway, that will fulfill the mitzvah. Rabbeinu Yonah says, no, no, no. Everybody's doing it wrong.
right? That's basically what he's saying. He's telling everybody, you're all doing it wrong. You say Shema at Shul, and then you say Shema before you go to bed, but I'm going to tell you, you have to do something new that you've never done before until you read my commentary, and that is that you should say Shema again at nightfall. In Rabbeinu Yonah's world, how many times is everybody saying Shema at night? Three times, right? Once at Shul, once when they get home, after nightfall, and then once before they go to bed. Three times.
And after Tikkun Chatzot.
What?
And after Tikkun Chatzot.
Oh, yeah? Okay. I don't know about Tikkun Chatzot.
Tikkun Chatzot in the midnight prayer.
Right. Okay. So, that's Rabbeinu Yonah. We're going to go back now and learn the Tosafot approach, Rabbeinu Tam's approach. Before we do that, we just have to have some background information, and that's on page 2. It's a Mishnah later on in Masechet Brachot on page 2. The Mishnah in the 4th chapter of Brachot tells us about the times for davening. The assumption in the Mishnah and in the Gemara is that Shema and davening are two completely different enterprises. Shema is a biblical mitzvah. Tefillah is the Shemona Esrei that we say. It happens to be that there is a requirement of Smichat Geula L'Tefillah, that the Bracha of Ga'al Yisrael, which surrounds the Shema, be said immediately before Shemona Esrei. And that's why we do it together. But really, they're two different things. Right? Really, we have Shema and we have Shemona Esrei. We do them together in the morning and together at night only because of that external requirement of the last bracha of the Shema to be connected to Shemona Esrei. But really, the assumption, the general assumption is that they're not really connected from a theoretical perspective. That's important to know. And the Mishnah, therefore, has separate times for Shema and separate times for the Amidah. The time for Shema at night, we've already discussed. It's after nightfall. The Amidah, however, is found on the 4th chapter. Tfilat HaShachar Ad Chatzot. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Ad Arba Asha'ot. There's two opinions as to when you can daven Shacharis, the morning prayer. According to the rabbis, it's until midday. And according to Rabbi Yehuda, it's until the 4th hour, so 2 hours before 2 hours before the rabbis. 2 hours before midday. Tfilat ha-mincha ad ha-erev. Mincha can be said until sunset. Rabbi Yehuda omer ad plag ha-mincha. Rabbi Yehuda disagrees and said it can be said until plag ha-mincha, which is an hour and a half before sunset. According to halachic times, not hour times, right? the 12 hours of sunlight, the day from the morning till the night is divided into 12 equal hours. So, you know, around the fall and the spring, it's pretty consistent with hour times, but now, for example, it's not so consistent. So there's a debate as to when mincha can be said. Rabbi Yehuda says it can only be said until an hour and a half before sunset. And the rabbis say it's until sunset. Tfilat ha'erev ein lakeva. And ma'ariv doesn't have anything specific. Presumably, ma'ariv can only be said after the time for mincha ends. So the assumption would be that according to the rabbis, mincha can be said until sunset, and ma'ariv must therefore be said after sunset. According to Rabbi Yehuda, mincha can be said until an hour and a half before sunset, until plag ha'mincha. And Ma'ariv can be said after that, meaning before sunset, you could say Ma'ariv, as long as it's after Plag HaMincha. That's the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. The Gemara then goes on to say that we don't paskin either way. Lo itamar hilchasa lo kemar velo kemar. That we don't paskin, not like the rabbis, and not like Rabbi Yehuda. And therefore, every community will have their own custom. Meaning some communities will daven mincha before sunset and ma'ariv after sunset, and some communities will daven mincha before plag ha-mincha and ma'ariv after plag ha-mincha. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, by the way, said that gemara, lo itamar hilchasa lo kamar velo kamar, means that every day you can pick a different one.
That's why in New York City, many shuls in the summer daven mincha ma'ariv a little bit earlier. So during the winter, they daven at sunset like we do. Mincha before sunset, ma'ariv after sunset. But once you change the clocks, they move it up and they daven mincha before plag and ma'ariv after plag, so people don't have to go out at, you know, late at night. So mincha ma'ariv is basically around 6:45, 7 o'clock throughout the summer and doesn't get any later than that. Because Rav Moshe said that everybody can choose each day whatever they want to do. As long as you just have to pick one for the day. Tosafot, take this Gemara and apply it to Kriyat Shema. Take a look on page 3. Page 3 is now our first page from last week's source packet. It's the first page of Masechet Brachot. And it's the same Tosafot we read. If you look on the left, we read up until where the underline begins. We read all the questions Tosafot have. Now we're going to read Rabbeinu Tam's answer. Page 3 on the left. Lachein Piresh Rabbeinu Tam. Therefore, Rabbeinu Tam explained the following. Da'adarabba. Kriyat Shema shel Beit HaKnesset Ikar. Rabbeinu Tam says, no, Rashi is wrong. You don't fulfill the mitzvah with bedtime Shema. And he's wrong that you don't fulfill it with the Shul Shema. The Shema you say in Shul is the mitzvah Shema. Even though you say it in the afternoon, in the days of Rashi and Tosfot, they daven Ma'ariv very, very early when it was still light outside. We discussed that because it was dangerous to go outside. It was dangerous to travel to Shul in the dark. So they wanted to do everything when it was still bright, daylight outside. So they would daven Mincha and Ma'ariv in daylight, presumably holding like Rabbi Yehuda, that you can daven Ma'ariv after Plaga Mincha. And so Rabbeinu Tam says that the Shema that you said in Shul, in broad daylight, as opposed to the Mishnah says that you have to say Shema after nightfall, when it's dark. But Rabbeinu Tam says, no, the Shema you said in Shul, that counts. That's the mitzvah Shema. You don't have to repeat Shema at all. Why? Ve'im tomar, hayach anu korin kol kach mi be'od yom. And so you'll ask, how do we say it in broad daylight? How can that possibly fulfill the nighttime Shema, which the codified Mishnah says must be said after nightfall? How can we say it so early? V'yesh lomar, dekaimalan k'Rebbe Yehuda. He answers, we hold like Rebbe Yehuda. Da'amar beperek tfilat ha-shachar. Dizman tfilat mincha ad plaga mincha. We hold like Rabbi Yehuda, who said in the fourth chapter of Tractate Brachot that mincha is until an hour and a half before sunset. Dehainu achadasar sheot pachot revia. Umiyad kshiikalez mana mincha. Matchil zman arvit. And immediately, so it's an hour and 15 minutes before sunset. Miyad, sheikalez man ha-mincha, matchil zman arvit. And immediately when mincha ends, what is the time for? Ma'ariv. But note the swift move that Rabbeinu Tam made. The Gemara and the Mishnah, everybody up until Rabbeinu Tam, assumed that Shema and Shemona Esrei are two completely separate realms and have different rules that apply to them. Rabbeinu Tam, without explaining himself, assumes, or basically posits in the background, that Shema and Shemona Esrei can go by the same times. Because he says that the mitzvah of Shema is fulfilled in broad daylight in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. But Rabbi Yehuda wasn't talking about Shema. He was talking about Shemona Esrei, about the Amida. It's remarkable. He doesn't even explain himself. No, everybody agrees that nightfall. It's a remarkable move by Rabbeinu Tam. Let's continue reading the Rabbeinu Tam. The im tomar hayach. So now he goes even further. The im tomar hayach anu mitpalalin tefilat mincha samoch lechashecha vafilu leachar plaga mincha. Rabbeinu Tam then goes on a completely different thing. He says, by the way, we don't daven you know, the Gemara would have assumed that you're not allowed to daven Mincha and Maariv in the same category of time. So if you daven Mincha after Plag HaMincha, then at least Maariv needs to be after sunset. So you're not in the same block of time. That's the Gemara assumed. So now Rabbeinu Tam says, we daven Maariv before sunset, and when we daven Mincha, after Plag HaMincha. We daven Mincha after the Plag, and Maariv before sunset, meaning in the same block of halachic time, they daven both, presumably contradicting each other. So it's called Tarte de Sasre. Two davenings, two tefillot that contradict each other. What? That's exactly what he's going to say. Take a look. They do. It's an amazing swift move. Okay. Yesh lomar, de kaimalan kerabanan, de amrei zman tefila samincha ad ha'erev. We hold like the rabbis that mincha is until sunset. V'amrinan lekavan hashna delota mar hilchas alo kemar velo kemar david kemar avad udu avad kemar avad. They basically say that when we daven mincha, we hold like the rabbis that it's until sunset you can daven mincha, and then that same day we change and now we hold like Rav Yehuda and we daven maariv before sunset. Okay. Following what Rabbeinu Tam's doing? Okay. It's remarkable. I mean, if I made that decision here, they would throw me out. To make, right? They hold like the rabbis at Mincha, and then immediately after Mincha, we change our mind, and we hold like Rabbi Yehuda, and now we can daven Maariv before sunset. Okay? There are shuls that do that. My old shul does that also in the summer. Mincha Maariv is at 6:45, regardless of, you know, any sunset or anything. Basically holding like Minhag Ashkenaz HaKadmon, the old Minhag Ashkenaz. And in many places in Europe, they also do this because the times, you know, what we call an hour and a half or an hour and a quarter in halachic times in Europe in the summer can be 3-4 hours long. So people aren't going to wait. You know, it'd be very, very difficult to get a minyan for both. And so the old Minhag Ashkenaz is always to sort of follow these opinions. But my question for today is, how can Rabbeinu Tam do this? I mean, how can he say, he basically invents the idea that you could say that the times of Shema are equal to the times of Shemona Esrei. Nobody else says that. He made that up. And number two, how could he then say this whole thing that you daven Mincha at the same time as you daven Maariv? So this week and next week, we're going to look at two approaches of explaining Rabbeinu Tam. Today we're going to look at the historical approach, and then next week we're going to look at a philosophical approach. So there's been much written about the history of customs in Ashkenaz. Take a look on page 4. This is taken from Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik. He is Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik's son. He lives in Riverdale. And he's probably the foremost scholar on the intellectual history in Ashkenaz who's alive today. He studied at Hebrew University. I mean, he studied with his father, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik. He's a, you know, Talmud Chacham to begin with. But then he studied history under the greatest scholars, Jacob Katz, Israel Tashba, at Hebrew University. And these are really the scholars of history of halacha. And nowadays, he's really the foremost scholar on the history of halacha in Ashkenaz, at least. And so he has, you know, they recently published 2 volumes of his collected essays. So we're going to look at just the little portions of 3 of his essays about the Tosafos. First, on page 4, about Minhag Ashkenaz HaKadmon, in a lengthy and influential article, Israel M. Tashma, who was a very significant professor of Jewish history at Hebrew University, passed away about 12 years ago, has portrayed unique significance and force that custom possessed in Ashkenaz, wholly unlike the subsidiary role that it played in other West European Jewish cultures of the Middle Ages. In early Ashkenaz, from 950 to 1096, religious life was conducted according to custom and custom alone. When a conflict was detected between the prescriptions of the Talmud and popular practice, the latter prevailed, not simply by force of habit, but out of the deep conviction that the law embodied in the traditional conduct of the people should override any formal written dictate. In the course of the 12th century, the law inscribed in the Talmud came to predominate in Ashkenaz, but only after a bitter struggle with custom. Okay, so the first thing is, for a long time, historians have been talking about how in Ashkenaz, custom was very, very important. In another essay, if you look on page 5, Professor Soloveitchik distinguishes between two categories of custom. From queries received over the years about religious law and change, it is clear that I should have prefaced that article, and we're going to read a portion of that article in just a moment. But I just wanted to look at this distinction first. I should have prefaced that article with a distinction that Jacob Katz used to make between two terms, minhag and nohag. The Rambam makes the same distinction, by the way. These may be roughly translated as custom and customary practice. Better yet, custom and habitual practice. Minhag, he says, is a halachic category. There are things that are a certain minhag, and he explains three different things. A minhag may, the exact terminology isn't significant. The different concepts conveyed by these two words are custom, has a recognized threefold place in halacha. It may adjudicate between two halachic views. For example, the custom of Ashkenaz is to follow Tosfos, the custom of Sfarad is to follow Maimonides. That's number one, right? We follow the Ramah, they follow the Shulchan Aruch. That's one kind of custom, another kind of custom. It may tilt the balance of an issue in which the law is unclear. B'makom shalacharo fefet. So for example, there are certain areas where halacha is unclear based on pure textual analysis. And so, you might observe what the custom is, and that will tilt the halacha one way or the other. Finally, it may determine the conduct in the interstices of the halacha. I don't know how to pronounce that word. There being no directives in the normative literature on the subject. Much of our daily prayer is custom, and such phrases as in Poland, it is customary not to recite Av Rachamim, and so on and so forth. You might notice in the Art Scroll Siddur, on Shabbos morning, when we take out the Torah, there's a Polish version of the of Kel Aruch HaPayim, and there's the Lithuanian version. I mean, that's just custom. One custom say it the other way. What characterizes minhag, where the bracket is, custom, in all of these instances, is that the practices described are both legitimate and recognized by their practitioners as part of the religious inheritance of the community. When it comes to local minhag, all Jewish communities are remarkably tenacious in defending their customs and vindicating their religious traditions. And little distinction can be drawn among different Jewish cultures of the Middle Ages, or of the modern period for that matter. Nohag, habitual practice, on the other hand, refers to conduct that is not viewed as custom, not perceived as part of a conscious religious tradition, but simply the way people of a community have traditionally acted on the assumption that these practices are legitimate, are in accord with the halacha. They're not customs. So what I will point out is that what we're discussing, the time for davening ma'ariv, is not a minhag. It's not that the French in France or in Germany, there was an explicit custom to daven mincha ma'ariv at 7 o'clock. That was just the nohag. That was the habitual practice. And they assumed that it was proper according to halacha. Okay? That's the distinction that we're making between minhag and nohag. Nohag, habitual practice, is just what people do, and they assume it to be proper because that's what they've been doing. As opposed to minhag, which actually has a place in halacha. Okay. Next page. Page 6. Now we're going to look at Professor Chaim Soloveitchik's great thesis about why, and this thing that we saw in Tosfos, where they seem to value popular practice over the textual halacha. Right, again, the Talmud and the textual halacha. Let's paint the question again. The Talmud and the Mishnah all would seem to say that, number one, Shema must be recited when it's dark outside after nightfall. And two, that Mincha and Maariv must be davened at separate halach times. And we saw that Rabbeinu Yonah, the Sephardic Rishon, he said, he added a new Shema. He told you all, you know, you're doing it wrong when you're davening Shema and Shul. You can daven Shema and Shul, but then you have to say it again later on. Okay? So Rabbeinu Yonah has that perspective. The Tosafot justify the popular practice. As a, you know, it, rather than telling their communities you're all doing it wrong, let me tell you what you should all do. The Tosafot, in a remarkable move, justify the popular practice. What drove them to do that? So that's Dr. Soloveitchik's great thesis here. The process I have described is, of course, a schematic one, and has been used primarily as expositional evidence. Self-images are seldom the product of simple linear thinking. But what we unquestionably have before us is the way in which a community's self-image can change over the course of its legal thought. The Franco-German, namely Ashkenaz, community was permeated by a profound sense of its own religiosity, the rightness of its traditions, and could not imagine any sharp difference between its practices and the law that its members studied and observed with such devotion. Because in Ashkenaz people were so frum, they couldn't imagine that there was a halacha that contradicted what their practice was. The Provençal Jewish community and Spanish communities, namely where Rabbeinu Yonah came from, on the other hand, wrestling as they were with, or what they perceived to be, widespread religious laxity, had no such self-image. And it never occurred to the scholars of these communities, many of whom were in every sense intellectual heirs of the French Tosafists, to seek to align their people's practices with the written word. People in Sfarad, in the Sephardic countries, weren't as frum. And so it wasn't crazy for the rabbi to get up and say, you know, you're really not doing this right. Here's a new practice you should all adopt. In France, where everybody died, you know, they were all really religious and really pious. So for the rabbi to say, everybody's been doing this wrong for the last 200 years, would have been crazy, because they're all so religious. But in the Sephardic countries, where they weren't all so religious, there was laxity, there was business going on, Shabbos and Yom Tov. Not everybody was so religious in the Sephardic countries. It wasn't crazy for the rabbi to get up and say, really, we're not doing this right. Because everybody thought anyway we're not doing anything right, because they weren't so religious. More accurately, okay. Or more accurately, they never imagined that contemporary conduct was informative of Talmudic law. Another point is that the Sephardic commentaries would not believe that what people do, nohag, could actually impact the halacha. It was a textual tradition. So what I analyze, and that's from Maimonides also, right? Maimonides analyzed the Talmud and came up with the Mishnah Torah. With complete, it didn't really matter to him what the popular practice was. And in many of his letters that he writes to people, he tells them, you're all doing this wrong, you should do it this way instead. That was the common Sephardic view. The Sephardic view was that the text is all correct, and we're going to follow the textual approach. And they could never imagine that just because people do something, that should impact what the psak is. They never imagined that the contemporary conduct was informative of Talmudic law, that the deeds of the common folk were revelatory of the divine intent. The Franco-German community, in its state of intense religiosity, saw the word of God as being, as it were, incarnated in two forms. First, in the canonized literature, the Talmud. Second, in the life of its people. Right? In Ashkenaz, they believe there were two sources of divine law. What the Talmud says and what the people are doing. If the new dialectical method, and the Tosafos introduced this dialectical method, we didn't really discuss this, but Tosafos introduced the idea that you know, when Rashi wrote his commentary, he basically just explained what the Gemara says here. Tosafos introduced the idea that you present contradictions from other Gemaras. So, for example, they read the Gemara here, and they read the Gemara there, and there's two different opinions. And then Tosafos feel like they somehow solve the contradiction. So this dialectical method, with its sweeping collation of the most varied sources, with its constant juxtaposition of contradictory passages, discovered that among the contradictions uncovered was one not simply between a passage in the first volume of Talmud and another passage in the last, but between a passage in the Talmud and the practice of a God-fearing community. To the Tosafists, the problem was one and the same. A contradiction between the Gemara in Brachos and the Gemara in Psachim is just as difficult as the contradiction between the Gemara in Brachos and the practice in Ashkenaz. The resolutional tool of dialectic was and is distinction. And whether the conflict was between two passages in the law or between life and law, to the Tosafists, the solution to both was a radical interpretation of the halacha, which is what we saw. A radical interpretation of the halacha, of Kriyas Shema, and of the times for davening. I would like to suggest that this approach that Tosafos took, and this distinction between Rabbeinu Yonah, the Sephardic Rishonim, and the Ashkenazi Rishonim, is not just a historical circumstance, but actually has to do with two very different views of custom, both of which are present in the Gemara. Take a look on page 7. The Gemara in Masechet Psachim, all the rules about customs appear in Masechet Psachim, the tractate about Passover, which shouldn't be surprising because Passover is all about custom. You know, but yeah, I have the custom, I don't eat hummus because it rhymes with chametz or whatever it is. You have different customs like that. So it shouldn't be surprising that many of the rules of customs appear in the tractate about Pesach. So the Gemara says the following, underlined portion at the bottom of page 7. Bnei Baishan nahug de lohavu azlin mitzor letzidon b'ma'ale shabta. The people in the city of Baishan had the custom not to go from Tzor, which is where they lived, to Tzido, which is another place, that's where the marketplace was, on Friday. The reason for that custom was that Tzor to Tzido, the journey might have been too long, and they might not make it home in time for Shabbos. And so the custom was that they didn't go from Tzor to Tzidon on Fridays, lest they tarry in Tzidon and not make it home for Shabbos. Atu banayhu kamei de Rabbi Yochanan. The children of Baishan came to Rabbi Yochanan. And they asked him, Amrulo, Avasin Efshar Lahu. Our parents, they were wealthy, and they could afford to not do their shopping on Friday, meaning get enough money, they had enough liquid assets to do all their shopping earlier in the week. And, you know, they had, you know, whatever they needed for the rest of the week. But Anan, La Efshar Lahu, we can't afford it. We need to shop more regularly because we don't have the money to buy things in advance. So we have to go on Friday to be set up for Shabbos. We can't not go to the market on Shabbos. Amar lahu kvar kiblu avoseichem aleichem. Your fathers have accepted this stringency, this custom upon them. Shene emar, shma bni musar avicha ve'al titosh torat imecha. The pasuk says in Mishle, listen, listen, my son, to the teachings of your father, to the ethics of your father, and don't leave the Torah of your mother. The interpretation is that Musar Avicha means halacha, and Torat Imecha means custom. So custom has the status of Torat Imecha. But they're separate things, right? Halacha is Musar Avicha, and Torat Imecha is custom. According to this Gemara, the rabbis derive that there is an obligation to follow one's custom. Okay? Musar Avicha, there's an obligation to follow halacha, and there's another obligation to follow custom, whatever your family's custom is. But there is another approach to minhag. Page 8, the last page. Not in the Shulchan Aruch, but it's used in all the commentaries, sure. That pasuk is the pasuk that's normally quoted about minhag. This appears right after the Mishnah. This is Nun Amud Beis, a page before this. Nun Amud Aleph is the Mishnah in Masechet Pesachim, Makom Shenahagu. The Mishnah about popular custom, about common custom. So it's in that chapter. Page 8, the underlined portion. The Mishnah had discussed, before this Gemara, you see where it says the line is right the Gemara, but the Mishnah over there discusses whether the Korban Pesach overrides Shabbos or whether it does not override Shabbos. So for example, if you, because slaughtering is usually prohibited on Shabbos. So does the Korban Pesach override Shabbos or does it not? Tanu Rabbanan, halacha zo nit'alma mibnei b'seira. This halacha, which is now in the Mishnah, was unknown to Bnei B'seira, to a group of people. They didn't remember the halacha. Pamachas chal arba'asar lios b'Shabbos. One time, the 14th of Nisan, which is when you give the Korban Pesach, fell on Shabbos. Shachachu v'lo yad'u im Pesach docheh et Shabbat im lav. And they forgot whether Pesach overrides Shabbos or not. Amru klum yesh adam sheyodea im Pesach docheh et Shabbat. They asked around and they said, is there anyone who remembers whether Pesach overrides Shabbos or not? Does anybody know? Well, I don't know what I'm saying. I'm just telling you what the story is. They went around there. Does anybody know? That's what they said. Does anybody know? Amru lahem adam echad yesh. There's one guy, she'alami bavel. He lived in Bavel and he now lives in Israel. The Hillel habavli shmo. His name is Hillel the Babylonian. Not the same Hillel as Hillel. It's a different Hillel, a later Hillel. Sheshimei shnei gdolei hador shmaya v'avtalyon. And he knows all this because he did shimush. He did rabbinic practice with two of the greatest sages of the generation, Shmaya and Avtalyon. So it goes on about how they hire him to become the Nasi. They hire him to become the head of the head of the court. Okay. Skip to the bottom. And now they ask him a bunch of questions. Here comes one question. Amru lo, Rebbe. Shachach velo hevi sakin. Me'erev Shabbos mahu. So now we know that Pesach does override Shabbos. But what happens, they ask him, if I forgot to bring my shechting knife, my slaughtering knife, before Shabbos? And you can't carry, right? You're not allowed to carry on the Sabbath. On Yom Tov, you are allowed to carry, so it wasn't a problem. But what happens if I forgot to bring the knife? Am I allowed to carry it or not? Amar lahen, halachazo shamati v'shachachti. Now Hillel HaBavli, who's supposed to have the great memory, says, I heard this halacha once, but I forgot it. Look, if Hillel HaBavli can forget a halacha, you should all forgive me sometimes when I forget a halacha once in a while. It's not the end of the world. Ella, Hanach lahen leYisrael. What should we do? We should go observe what the Jews are doing. Im ein neviim hen, bnei neviim hen. Because if they're not prophets, then they're all in training to become prophets. If they're not prophets, they're sons of prophets or apprentices of prophets. They're training to be prophets. And indeed, what do? They observe what everybody does, and they found that what the Jews do is they stick the knife into the horn of the ram, or into the wool of the sheep on the way to the to give the korban, so that they wouldn't have to carry it. But how do they learn the halacha? By observing what everybody does. Because iblav neviim hem, bnei neviim hem. That's another kind of famous quote that's used to explain the importance of custom, the importance of minhag. This is a very different view of custom, though, from Musar Avicha and Torat Imecha. And I'll explain why I think it's different. Musar Avicha v'Torat Imecha implies that there are two separate realms, halacha and custom. And there is an obligation to follow custom. However, if one's custom contradicts a halacha, then you would certainly go with Musar Avicha over Torat Imecha. You would pick the halacha over the custom. But im lav neviim hem, bnei neviim hem, if they're not prophets, are they sons of prophets, means something much more. It doesn't mean that there's an obligation to follow halacha, an obligation to follow custom. What it means is that the custom is a revelation of Torah. What are Nevi'im? Nevi'im are prophets, people that say the word of God. Halacha is a revelation of the word of God. So too is popular practice. It's a revelation of what God truly intended. That's what this Gemara means. That's the importance of custom, according to this Gemara. That minhag, too, is its own source of halacha. Because it itself, by virtue of this being the custom, is the revelation of what God truly intended. And I think that the Ba'aleya, that this difference in view of minhag explains the distinction between the Sephardic Rishonim, as quoted by Rabbeinu Yonah, and the Tosafos. Rabbeinu Yonah believes in the first version. Musar avicha, torati mecha. First you have to have musar avicha, and then for other things you can have torati mecha. You have to have halacha, you also have to have custom. But halacha certainly overrides it. But the Tosafos, as interpreted by Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, believe that in lav nevi'im hem, b'nei nevi'im hem. All of our people are very religious and they're very pious. And by virtue of their doing something, must imply that it is proper according to halacha, because im lav nevi'im hem, if they're not prophets, then they're the sons of prophets. Okay. This morning we looked at a historical interpretation of this Tosafot. Next week, please God, we're going to go all the way back. We're going to read Rabbeinu Tam again. But the briskers, the traditional yeshiva method of learning Gemara, reject this entire approach, because this is a historical approach. And in the brisker yeshivas, they feel that history has no impact on theoretical halacha. And you can argue with that if you'd like. However, that approach yields tremendous philosophical insight. I'm going to read a letter next week that Rav Soloveitchik, Rabbi Yosef Soloveitchik, who was a scion of the Brisker dynasty, wrote to his father when he was a young man with a completely new interpretation of Shema based on this Tosafot. He didn't say the Tosafot changed the rule because of popular practice, but he says that they have a completely different view of what Shema Yisrael is. And that's, please God, what we'll do next week. Have a good day.